The Money Cafe is brought to you by Eureka Report, your one-stop shop for all things finance. To sign up for your free 15-day trial, head to eurekareport.com.au. Now it's time to enjoy today's episode.
Hello, I'm Alan Kohler, founder of Eureka Report, finance presenter on the ABC News and columnist for the New Daily.
And I'm James Thompson, Chanticleer columnist at the Australian Financial Review.
And we are the Money Cafe. You are, in fact, the senior Chanticleer columnist.
Almost. Yes. Yes.
You're not. Well, I think that's a good thing.
Yes, thank you.
Now, you got up earlier this morning to listen to Jerome Powell's press conference.
I did.
I did not.
Yes. It was very exciting. Usually, Jerome, and there was actually some statistics done on this, that the volatility in markets when Jerome speaks is three times higher than his two predecessors, Ben Bernanke and Janet Yellen. So that's
because, while he's speaking.
While he's speaking. And right. That's because he's got a bad habit of...
Someone has measured this, have they?
Yeah, someone's measured this. And he's got a bad habit of announcing something bad, e.g. a rate cut, and then sort of talking it down a bit, trying to make nice. But today he was very, very, very strong. I thought he was stuck to the script really well. He basically said, we're here to fight inflation. Don't worry, the banks are fine. Don't worry, the economy is still hot. We need to fight inflation. And he really hammered home the message. So they increased interest rates by 0.25%. But effectively, this was a 0.5% interest rate hike because Powell said that the central bank, the banking sector shenanigans, turmoil, had tightened credit conditions such that that was an effective rate hike or a rate hike plus a little bit more. So the banking turmoil has done some of the Fed's heavy lifting for it, and they could increase rates by 0.25% while having a bigger impact on inflation, or so they hope.
Right. So, did he say in the press conference that they're going to keep hiking?
Yeah, he said that he left the door open to further increases. The sort of prediction of the Fed members, so the Fed governors from around America, is that rates will top out at 5.1%. So that would suggest one more rate hike in the next meetings in May. But that's where things get interesting. So the bond market is saying that the rest of the year, the Fed is cutting every single meeting, which infers that the US economy is going to be in a pretty dark place. But Powell and the rest of the Fed, they're saying we hold rates at 5.1% till the end of 2023. And by the end of 2024, rates are sitting at 4.6%. So two cuts, basically. You know, a couple of cuts.
During next year.
So this is the higher for longer message coming through loud and clear. He is saying it will take years to get inflation.
The bond market is obviously predicting a recession in the US.
Absolutely, a hard recession.
And what about the economists, leaving aside the market? What are the economists saying? I mean, most of them are talking about recession as well, aren't they?
Yeah, I think the chances of a recession are pretty. I think some sort of recession is locked in.
I looked at I think it was the conference board's probability of recession.
Yep.
Chart.
Yep.
And it's at 90%.
Yes. Now, how deep's that recession is the question, right? You look at the bond market, it's saying something awful is coming. What Powell and that are saying is, hey, the soft landing is still viable, but I reckon the soft landing is getting harder and harder.
So I suppose the question for us here in Australia is, if as expected, the Reserve Bank pauses whether an American recession equals an Australian recession?
I think that's a good question. And I guess you might ask, is there any problems with the Fed and the RBA being out of sync? They've been pretty in sync during most of this cycle. So,
well, they're already kind of out of sync in the sense that the RBA is at 3.6 and the Fed's at 4.6.
Yes,
so that's a fair difference.
Yeah, but they've been going hike for hike, I guess, is what I'm trying to say there. So does the RBA...
No, I understand what you mean.
you would have to think that a recession, I mean, history says a recession in the US is not good for Australia, but I reckon
Well, they had one in 2008 and we didn't.
Yeah, true, true.
And they had one in 2000 and we didn't.
Yes, yes.
So,
and you might say the mitigating factor of China's even stronger now for us. You know, we're going to get, we've got a rebounding China, we've got Chinese tourism, Chinese students coming back. So that should help us. Maybe that insulates us a bit.
Well, it's, maybe which is, we can. Which is ironic, since we're spending $368 billion to protect ourselves from China.
Yes, using the using the taxes made from selling iron ore to
China.
Yes. yes. I'm not sure what to say about that, but no, you're exactly right.
Ideally that we're living in an episode of Utopia.
Yes, that's right. Yeah.
Anyway, so what do we think about Credit Suisse going down?
Oh, look, I guess my first reaction is I can't believe how quickly it happened. But then when you hear that...
But it's been going for years.
It has been going for years, I know. But their capital ratios, their liquidity numbers are better than the banks in the US and better than some banks in Australia. I mean, these are the things we're supposed to watch to say, is a bank about to disappear? And it didn't matter a jot. Just didn't matter. So I find that, extraordinary.
Just to be clear, the reason it didn't matter was because everyone was taking their money out of Credit Suisse, right?
Yes.
And the problem is that they were losing billions and billions of dollars a day.
Yes, but it wasn't a GFC credit problem. This was a sentiment problem. This was a confidence problem, right?
Yeah.
And I find it amazing that, you know, it is like that Hemingway quote, you go bankrupt slowly and then awfully quickly. I mean, the trust is broken and then it just disappears really rapidly. The GFC, it took 18 months. You know, the distance between Bear Stearns being rescued and Lehman Brothers going under is 6 to 9 months, right? We've had two major bank rescues in 10 days. Like, that is extraordinary.
Yeah.
I mean...
It's interesting that the deal where they're selling Credit Suisse to UBS... wipes out the bondholders, or at least some of those bondholders, $17 billion worth of bondholders.
Yeah, and this has caused great consternation among the bondholders.
They're going to sue now.
Well, I'm not sure what grounds they'll sue on, though. I just don't get this, because it's in the documentation. It's in the documentation of Australian bank hybrids that there are circumstances where the regulators might need to do something extraordinary, and that's what's happened. So what grounds do you sue on? We didn't read the documents that well?
Well, I read... reaction from them, and they're saying, we've been robbed.
Yeah, well, they
would feel like, our money.
They would feel like that. But I don't know. I mean, you know, the interesting bit is, what does this mean for sort of lending and credit supply around the world? So banks sort of get more wary of each other. Wholesale funding costs go up. The banks have got to work harder for deposits. Do they have to tighten the supply of credit to the Main Street?
I think we've learnt over the last few weeks that banking is basically a part of government.
Yeah.
I mean, I wrote that this morning in the New Daily, but you were too busy listening to Jerome Powell to read it, of course.
Apologize.
But basically, I'm saying that banks are an arm of the state now.
Yeah.
And someone else tweeted, actually, no, it's the other way around. The governments are owned by the banks.
Yeah.
But look, however you look at it, it's clear that banking can't really exist without government support.
Yes.
You know.
It's always been the case, isn't it? I mean, banks are sort of an unusual public-private partnership in a way, because they're backstopped by...
Well, it hasn't always... The banking... The partnership, the fact that the banks are kind of partly owned by the governments, effectively, has evolved over time.
Yes.
Every time there's a crisis, the governments get more involved, right?
Yes.
And it began with the Great Depression, when 9,000 banks in the US went broke, and Franklin D. Roosevelt created the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, the FDIC, in 1933, which began the process of backstopping banks.
Yeah. Which continues to this very day, right now.
Exactly.
Yeah.
That's right. But I mean, the interesting thing about Silicon Valley Bank is that is that the it wasn't just some of the deposits up to a certain up to $250,000.
Yeah.
All of them were guaranteed.
Yeah.
Basically,
yeah.
they just came in and said everyone's made whole. It's yeah. fine.
Interestingly, Janet Yellen was this morning up in front of a Senate committee in the US, and she said that there was no need for a sector-wide guarantee of deposits over $250,000. Now, that sent some of these regional bank shares, which are being pummeled, that sent them, smacked them again. But do we really think that's what Janet says? I mean, they'll insure these deposits.
Of course.
Even if it's on a case-by-case basis.
I mean, in some ways, the way to look at it is that the phrase, too big to fail, has been shrinking. Like the size of the bank that qualifies for being too big to fail is coming down and down, right?
Yeah.
So now it's First Republic is too big to fail, or, you know, like which bank in Australia is too big to fail?
Yes.
Obviously the big four are, but is Bendigo too big to fail?
I mean, I think so. I mean,
of course.
This is the lesson, isn't it? Governments don't want anyone to feel any pain.
No.
And people obviously don't want to feel pain, but it is funny. I think there was a great... I think it was Thomas Friedman this week. I might have it wrong, but he said, you know, there's no... Everyone, no one's an atheist in a foxhole in the middle of war, and in the middle of a bank bailout, nobody is a free marketeer. Everybody right. believes in the government's
exactly.
The government's responsibility. So,
yeah.
But I think this does just highlight that we're not getting... You know... People had thought, oh, we move away from zero interest rates, the market will start working again. Well, no, the government is still going to be relied on to intervene at every step. And
yeah, well, there's
how long can that keep going? I don't know.
So both ANZ and Shane Oliver at AMP put out graphs in the past week or two showing that every time the Fed increases interest rates, something breaks.
Yeah.
It always happens.
Always happens, yeah.
Every time.
Yeah. And the government is expected to fix it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's get into some questions, shall we? We've
got tons of ones.
John says, I think everyone is a little shocked at the proposal to tax unrealised capital gains. And then he goes on, and what are your thoughts on this? Do you think it'll get past Parliament? Yeah, it's interesting. I don't know whether it'll get past Parliament. What do you think?
Yeah, it's a good question. That is probably this is the sticking point. John makes the point is governments have invented a way to tax inflation, which they themselves created, which is sort of an interesting way of thinking about it. I'm not sure. I think this is something that Dutton will try to use as a wedge, but I think crossbench support might get this through.
That's right. So what we have at the moment is basically the left has control of the Senate.
Yes.
So the balance of power is in the hands of the left, not the right.
Yeah.
So therefore, if there's a kind of a leftish proposal that the Labor Party's putting up, it'll probably get through. And what I find difficult to believe, is that it'll actually get that far.
It'll be knocked over at consultation.
Well, it was slipped into the proposal by Treasury. It looked like it was. It was kind of buried in the paperwork.
Yeah.
It wasn't kind of in any of the media releases or doorstops or interviews by Jim Chalmers or Anthony Albanese. So
surprise.
Yeah. So it was kind of stuck in there. They obviously, Chalmers and them knew it was there, obviously, but they haven't made anything of it.
Yes.
So I would reckon it was a little kite the Treasury flew that won't actually make it all the way.
Yes. Well,
but if it does make it all the way into the legislation, it'll get through.
Yeah, and it will be a little bit chaotic, a lot chaotic.
Yeah,
because there's some real wrinkles in that one.
Oh, it's a shocker.
Yeah. So
absolute shocker.
Yeah. Jarrett asks, can you please explain how the BetaShares Crude Oil Index ETF, which is 000.asx, generates cash to pay dividends?
Well, Jared, I looked on the website. There's a frequently asked question section,
right,
on it, which I'd suggest you have a look at. But that question you ask is not a frequently asked question. Ooh. However, it is clear from there that this ETF is trading in oil futures. It doesn't just buy oil or something.
Yeah.
Or track the oil price. It actually trades futures, and it generates income by rolling futures over And if they do it in a favourable way, they generate income. Now, I don't know quite how that works. I'm not an oil futures or any kind of futures trading expert.
Yeah.
However, it's clear in there. So I'd suggest you go onto the website, check out the frequently asked questions and follow it through. They've got a few. There's a couple of links that you can click on that take you to explanations of how that works.
Slightly spicy part of the market to play in too.
Well, you would think so, and it's not a bloody, it's not a boring ETF, that's for sure.
I bet.
Your turn.
Phil, I'm keen to get your thoughts on the legislation proposals around tightening up for the franking credit system. The first piece around franking credits, if they were funded by capital raising activities, seems fairly logical and fair to me. I don't know a lot about the second part around off-market buybacks and what impact that will have. I'm generally a fan of Jeff Wilson, but it seems like he's banging the drum excessively on this one. What are your thoughts?
That's doesn't sound like Jeff to bang the drum excessively.
He was in our paper in an ice bath the other day. I woke up on Saturday and there's a half-nude Jeff Wilson in my Wheaties. It was a bit of a shock. Look, I think to Phil's point, Jeff's actually less worried about the buybacks bit and more worried about the capital raising bit. So his point is that companies have their capital tied up in all sorts of things, particularly working capital to grow their business and that sort of thing. So raising capital to pay a dividend, particularly for a smaller business, isn't that exotic or unusual. It's a way of releasing these franking credits and getting them into the hands of shareholders. So his point is that blocking that outlet will particularly hurt smaller companies who, you know, don't have that much capital or have it or want to use it to grow their business and need to raise capital to unlock these franking credits. So you're right, Jeff is on a long campaign against this, but franking credits are important to his investors, so that's why.
Robert says, does a recession actually mean a share market downturn? Answer, yes.
Usually, yep. Yeah. And often the downturn comes after the recession started, when we start to see earnings roll over.
And there's another question later on about share market declining when interest rates start being cut. I'm just trying to find that question.
Yep. That is the historical relationship.
It is the case, and I can't find that question, but it is there later on. We'll get to it. It is the case that share markets do tend to decline when share markets are being cut because there is a recession going on. And that's the reason the share interest rates are being cut.
Yeah, and if you can imagine the lag effect, you know, central banks have to work at a bit of on a lag, and so that's why the cut, by the time they're cutting, the economy is in trouble.
Yeah.
Andrew says, I listened with interest as you dissected the latest news about China, Taiwan and Australia's new submarines. One issue that was left out of the discussion was TSMC, which is the largest independent semiconductor foundry in the world with 54% of the independent market. TSMC manufactures chips for Apple, Nvidia, numerous chips inside devices. In the event of an invasion, how much would it cost economically not to have access to all the devices that require those chips, say cars and all sorts of stuff? How much would this motivate the US, Australia and the rest of the world to protect Taiwan?
Yeah, well, I think that's a really interesting question. I've been thinking about this. I reckon in some ways the Chinese invasion of Taiwan would represent a hostile takeover of a semiconductor company.
Yeah.
I mean,
of the whole semiconductor industry. I mean, well, it's not just them.
Well, and imagine, I mean, I think Andrew's point is interesting because I don't think the world can do without TSMC's chips, right?
No.
The world would just basically grind to a halt.
No, you'd be.
So therefore, if China took it over, if China owned TSMC effectively, it would have everyone by the short and curlies.
Yes, and this is why TSMC is trying to build a foundry in America at an extraordinary amount. I can't remember it off the top of my head. I think it's $50 billion off the top of my head.
Really?
They're trying to get a foundry up in America for this exact reason, that it makes no economic sense. It's be cheaper and smarter to build to have the foundry in Taiwan, but they just want strategic independence from that this exact problem.
Yeah. Scott says, Alan has made the point several times that in order to balance the budget and pay for NDIS and Medicare, that the government has no choice but to further increase tax rate for those on higher incomes. I pay 50% tax and work incredibly hard as a medical professional for the privilege. Many of us in this position have earned very little for many years while studying and working in poorly paid jobs in public hospitals. I've wondered each time Alan makes this point, why is it fair that companies are taxed 20% less than me?
Yeah, Alan.
Yeah. I just would make the point, Scott, that you are actually paying the company tax. That the company tax is paid by the customers of the companies.
Mm-mm. That's an interesting way to look at it.
I mean, there is no thing that's a company that's separate to you.
So why does he have to pay 50% and 30% then?
It's even worse. Because in 1951, the top marginal tax rate was 75%, okay?
Mm.
And then it came down to 67%, and was that level basically until Hawke and Keating started cutting the top marginal tax rate, and they cut it to below 60%, yes. And then it came to below, and then it got to below 50%, right? And now 50% is the threshold, right? Nobody wants to pay more than 50% tax, right? Because that's, you know,
it's a huge impost.
It's a huge impost.
Yeah.
But it used to be normal.
Yes.
To pay 60 or 70% top marginal tax rate. And during that period, economic growth was 2.5% per annum. And now it's 2. I'm just saying that the idea that cutting the top marginal tax rate below 50% led to more growth,
yes,
is incorrect. But anyway, I'm not saying that it's going to go back above 50, but I am saying that, you know, there's not enough tax being raised.
No, there's...
That's it. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, the people who pay taxes, all of them, are households.
Yeah, yeah.
That's it.
I think Alan's point, Scott, is that there's hard decisions coming up. We've got some big, big things we need to afford, NDIS, Medicare, defence, and it's not really clear how we're going to pay for them.
And if the company tax rate was raised to 50%, they'd just put up their prices.
Yeah. Yes.
The other alternative is to put up the GST, which, you know, I mean, ours is 10%. The average around the world in the OECD companies is 15%. Finland, the happiest country in the world,
yes,
has a GST of 25%.
Yes.
So, you know.
Maybe that's the way, but a GST hits the poorest people.
Well, exactly. So that's why, you know, that's why this kind of threshold of 50% on the top marginal rate is a problem.
Yeah.
It seems to me.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Bryant says, after listening to last week's Money Cafe, I think you are the Margaret and David of investing podcasts. Is that you and Stephen, right?
Yeah, but who's Margaret?
Oh, not sure. She's a sensible one. I love the banter and diverse views. Easy question. Would Alan or Maria be able to interview someone from...
Oh, this is just an interview request.
Yes.
Orthocell. I have absolutely no idea who they are.
You spoke to them back in 2019.
Oh, well, I know exactly who they are.
They're in the bone and tissue regeneration business and made quite a bit of progress. So okay, an update request, please.
No worries. Last fortnight... Oh, this is a long question.
It's a good question, though. It's aimed at me, so ask it.
Oh, all right. Okay. Last fortnight, James made some comments questioning the sense of the safeguard mechanism, including a ban on new coal and gas projects. Specifically, how are you going to firm all the renewables without gas? Does James recognise that the only domestic gas shortage Australia will ever experience will be created by the gas extraction companies exporting our natural resources for greater profit instead of making the required amount available for domestic markets and so on? And he's got some links in there.
Yep.
And he says, I want my kids to live in an electrified world with less than 2 degrees C of warming. There is only one future place for gas, and that's in the ground.
Yes.
Cop that, James.
Fair enough, Leo. I guess I would ask how he hopes that Europe weans itself off Russian gas, because if they're not getting it from exports from countries like Australia, then they're not getting it from anywhere, and they'll go back to using coal and oil to heat their countries. So I'm not sure how Leo sort of plans to get us off gas in the short term. I think it would be great if we got off gas as soon as possible, but we're going to need some. We're going to need plenty of gas to firm up renewables and help Europe get off Russia's gas, which they became addicted to, in the short term. So
there's a little Australian listed company on the ASX called Po Valley Energy.
Right, yep.
Which has found some gas in the Po Valley in Italy. And
there you go.
And do you remember a financial planner named Kevin Bailey?
No.
No. No, he was famous.
Right.
And he's the chairman of it.
Oh, there you go.
Po Valley.
Yeah. Now, I mean, check it out. Leo's right. We want to get gas out of the system as quickly as possible, but we need more renewables. Those renewables need to be firmed, and the technology to firm
them. It needs to be storage.
Well,
it's from storage.
Like the Snowy Hydro that's
well, whatever.
5 years behind. And
no, there are tons of different storages.
Well, that's great, but like
there's one in
we want to start this now. We've got to get it going now.
There's one in Broken Hill working on compressed air storage in old mines.
Working on it.
Which is great.
Working on it. There's lots of great technology coming in 5 years. But between now and then, and I don't think Leo would like to wait 5 years to start the transition to renewables, we've got to make ground now.
Samuel says, love the podcast. Wondering what's the best way to learn about the Australian property market. Spent the last few years learning about equities and realised I knew nothing about property. I find a lot of property resources cheesy. Yeah. If you're in your mid-20s, how would you learn about the property market?
That's a good question. I'm not quite sure what the answer is here.
I mean, the best way to learn about it is buy an apartment if you can.
Well, don't buy an apartment. Yeah, don't buy an apartment.
Oh, no. Well, I'm just saying that because it's cheaper.
Yes.
That's all.
Well, I think you've just got to plough through some of the cheesy resources. I'd be thinking about the different types of property that are out there and the different ways you can get into the market.
You consume data. I mean, you can go to the CoreLogic website, CoreLogic.com.au.
Yeah.
They've got a lot of resources on that website that's free and it's not cheesy. You know, that's solid data.
Yep.
So you could learn about what's been going on in the past.
Yeah, and some of the big commercial real estate agents have really good outlook reports that, again, are pretty data heavy and you'll find out a lot about commercial property through that.
There's another site called SMQ. I think this is Louis Christopher's.
Yeah, SQM.
Yep. SQM.
Yep.
You could look up SQM,
yep.
see what he's got. Louis's got free on his website.
He's a very straight talker too.
Definitely not cheesy. Ramnish says, I just received my annual land valuation from the Queensland Department of Resources with the values up nearly 50%. I am in the fortunate position of owning a couple of investment properties, so the valuation will surpass the land tax threshold. While I accept land values have risen, is it not a conflict of interest if one state department values a parcel of land for tax to be collected for its own state government?
Oh.
Yes.
Yes, possibly. There's a lot of interesting things going on in property valuation at the moment. I wrote a column this week about the commercial property world where they've essentially pretended that commercial property valuations haven't moved.
Yeah.
And they can do this because they get independent valuations of all the properties. The independent valuations are based on recent transactions. And guess what? There's been no recent transactions because nobody wants to sell at a loss. And what happens? We get valuations that don't move. So I think there's a bit of interesting stuff going on in the world of property valuations, but I don't see how our correspondent's going to get around
well,
this one.
Property, just to be clear, property is valued, particularly commercial property, on the basis of capitalisation rates or cap rates, as they're called, which are basically the 10-year bond rate.
Hmm.
And the lower the cap rate, the higher the valuation. And they all went up. They all been enjoying high valuations as the bond rates fell to almost nothing.
Yes.
And now the bond rate's going up.
And cap rates haven't moved.
Well, gee. Yeah.
What a shock.
I know.
Anyway, Robert asks, from the start of 2023, he's writing to us from Whistler. In Canada's ski fields. He says, from the start of 2023, Canada's introduced a two-year ban on foreign residents owning residential real estate. Commercial real estate is exempted. This sounds like a sensible solution to the Australian housing crisis while still allowing foreign investment in commercial real estate. What are your thoughts?
Well, I don't know. Apparently a house was sold in Hawthorne the other day for $40 million.
Right. Next door to your joint?
I wish. to a Chinese person.
Yeah.
So there's money coming into Australia. $40 million has landed in someone's bank account in Australia. it was sold by the super retail To do with someone in the retail business anyway.
Right.
So, look, I don't know. I mean, why is it 2 years? What's going on in Canada? I have no idea. Do you know any idea what they might be doing?
They had the same issue as Australia, that their house prices went absolutely cocoa bananas, and there was a lot of work done in Canada that suggested the housing industry was used to launder money, basically. Used to bring money in. So this is a reaction to that issue, a way of taking action on house prices. I think we joked before about the subs and all that sort of stuff and protecting ourselves from the same China we need to boost the economy. This is a similar thing. We need Chinese students. We need more migration to fill skills gaps. Sort of feels a bit, you know, robbing Peter to pay Paul to put a ban on foreign property investment.
Greg's told us we have to do one more question.
Okay. Dealer's choice.
Dealer's choice. I don't know. We'll just do the next one. Lachlan says, you've stated several times on the show that paying off your mortgage was the worst investment decision you've made because it's now limited your access to cheap funding sources to invest in the market.
Oh, okay.
That was Stephen, actually, not me.
Right.
But he paid off his mortgage and then suddenly didn't have any...
He couldn't redraw
on his mortgage.
I never thought of it like that.
What options have you considered? This bloke, Lachlan, says, I've also paid down my mortgage while I sleep better at night. I'm in the same boat. What options have you considered to unlock your home equity, reverse mortgage, margin loan, personal loan? Well, I'd say go to the bank and apply for a portfolio facility, which is just a loan that you don't necessarily draw. They approve it. They give it to you. As long as you can theoretically repay it. If your home's worth $1 million and you get a portfolio facility of $500,000, worth 50, so 50%
secured
against your house, but it's undrawn,
yes,
they're still going to assess you on the basis that you are repaying it because you might be.
Yes.
Because it's your option. So I've paid off most of my mortgage, but I've still got it sitting there.
Mm.
I can redraw it if I need to.
Yeah, okay.
If I want to do a renovation or do something.
It's an interesting point, though, because, the likes of the Barefoot Investor would tell you get that mortgage paid off and that gives you sort of financial freedom and, as Lachlan says, you sleep better at night. But
you can pay the mortgage down or off, in fact, and not have any repayments. Sleeping better at night, but you've still got the ability to redraw it if you need it.
Right.
As long as you don't close the account. I mean, you keep it with $10 owing or something like
that. Right. Okay. It's something I'd never thought of. I'm sort of with Lachlan. I'd like to sleep better at night.
But you can sleep better at night with the ability to draw on the loan.
Yes.
But as long as it's what NAB at least calls a portfolio facility. I don't know what the others call it.
Something similar. They're all the same.
Yeah. Yeah, that's what it's called.
Yeah, there's some options, Lachlan.
There you go.
Good question.
And that's it. Thanks, everyone, for listening to today's episode of Money Cafe. It's been absolutely hosing down outside, so we couldn't sit in our normal spot because the rain was clattering on the roof, but here we are inside. And it's worked fine. And it's been a thunderstorm this morning. Amazing.
Yeah. Pure Melbourne.
Stephen Mayne will be back next week. So send in a question to themoneycafe@eurekareport.com.au and we will answer it. Until then, I'm Alan Kohler, founder of Eureka Report, etc.
And I'm James Thompson, Chanticleer columnist at the Australian Financial Review. I'm going to be off for a few weeks. So, Alan, I'll see you when I return from holidays.
Why wasn't I told?
Ha ha ha.